Hello and welcome to The Third Opinion Uncensored. This is a podcast exploring public health, media, science, health and well-being, and censorship in and beyond the times of COVID. We look beyond the media headlines to create a space for critical thinking, intelligent debate, and the freedom to dialogue. This week, we will be interviewing Emeritus Professor Robert Clancy, AM. He is a practicing clinical immunologist, or maybe he's retired now. I think he's a retired clinical immunologist with an international reputation for research in autoimmune disease, immunization, and mucosal inflammatory disease. He was Foundation Professor of Pathology at the University of Newcastle, where he established the Newcastle Mucosal Immunology Group, who identified mechanisms of airway protection and the pathogenesis of mucosal disease and discovered new methods of disease control. In fact, he developed the vaccine Broncostat at the University of Newcastle in 1985. And the Broncostat vaccine reduced attacks of acute bronchitis to 90% degree. Professor Clancy, welcome to the show. Can you hear me?
Oh, welcome. Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today. It's a privilege to have you here. But first of all, maybe you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to be the man you are today.
Well, I'm a clinical immunologist. I'm a physician, an internist, and I graduated. There was no such thing as clinical immunology. And yet that's exactly what I wanted to be. And when I finished my internal medicine training, I did a PhD in autoimmune disease at Monash University in autoimmune disease platelets, which are one of the three formed elements within blood to stop you bleeding. And I then went to McMaster University, where I established a clinical immunology practice and set up the unit there. But at the same time, I worked with Professor John Bienstock, who was on the verge of describing the way in which the different mucosal surfaces and that really established both my clinical and my research. I came back to Australia and set up the clinical component of clinical immunology at Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. Then from there, after several years, I was appointed to a foundation chair of pathology at the Castle, which was the world's second problem-based learning school after McMaster.
You developed the first Australian vaccine, as in the first Australian who developed a international vaccine. Is that correct?
No, I've never developed a vaccine. What I did was worked on the way in which the various mucosal surfaces of the body communicate. And in doing that, I realized that individuals don't necessarily deliver highly effective protection in the airways, because the protection comes from the gut, and was make that process work much more efficiently. Shift people being prone to infections to less prone to getting infections, and in a sense, if you like it, in a way, it works like a vaccine, but it's not really a vaccine. It's a natural product that works through what we call the common mucosal system, that is the system that allows the communication between the gut and the lung, because the lung doesn't the lung has one job, and that really is to exchange gases and oxygen in and carbon dioxide out. What I did was showed that in humans, the way in which the lung protects itself is to swallow the contents of the airways with the bacteria and the virus, and then that is taken up by little lymphoid tissue aggregates, which are in the wall of the small bowel and corpus patches. And then from there, the active immune cells migrate through the bloodstream back to the lung. But this is a very imperfect system. And we were making it if not perfect, close to perfect, by providing large amounts of this stimulus in the form of killed bacteria. So it's not really a vaccine. It really is a natural product that is allowing a protective system to work more efficiently.
So were you the first person to recognise that this link between the mucosa of the gut and the importance of that in protecting the lungs?
No, I think that for many years the people have realised there's some sort of linkage. I was a small part of a team that formally showed that this could be demonstrated by taking cells that you could get from these aggregates and put them into rabbits and show that the rabbits could actually exchange this message between the lining of the gut and the lining of the lungs.
And
what I think we did, we made this work in humans, which hadn't been done before, and we were able to develop from that a product which can improve and significantly the health outcome of people who have got chronic lung disease and also people who are considered normal but still prone to getting bad outcomes from virus infections.
So does the bronchostat still exist? Is that still being used?
Bronchostat was something we developed it.
Mm-hmm.
We developed it more as a tool to show that these communication pathways existed.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the people who were funding our work were very keen to have produce this, and it was very effective. But it was produced very early in the cycle of research. Now is being much more sophisticated way, and hopefully we will develop this relatively soon as a product that people can use. But at the moment, that's a process occurring. It should have occurred a long time ago, but you need to understand that at the moment, effective treatment for people with chronic lung disease is not very good, but still makes a lot of money for the big pharmaceutical companies.
Mm.
And they don't like, you know, small people like us coming along having something that works better than their product. So it's always a bit of a struggle.
Would a dose of bronchostat be beneficial to someone suffering from COVID?
Could you say that again, please?
Sure. Would a dose of bronchostat be helpful for somebody who's suffering with COVID symptoms?
Look, we've got trouble communication.
The question was, would bronchostat be something that would work with someone who had COVID symptoms, was the question.
With what, COVID?
Yes.
No. It's bronchostat's not a term we use anymore. It's an oral activated bacterial preparation. What it does, it means when a virus affects the airways, say a COVID virus or a flu virus, what it does, it should be contained to the local response. And what we've been able to do is to shift that containment so that it occurs much more efficiently and effectively.
Mm.
So I think the answer is for any viral infection, go back and look at 100 people who are consider themselves normal. If they all get COVID, 95% of those, 95 of that 100 are going to have a very mild disease. But 2 or 3% are going to get very sick, and one of them might go to hospital and could even die. And the difference between what we've been able to show is that the probable difference between the ones who die and the ones who get very sick and the ones who don't is that this common mucosal system works in an imperfect fashion. And what we do by making the system work more perfectly, better, we shift that risk, if you like, we de-risk that person from getting a severe episode. It's quite different to a vaccine, which stimulates a immunity that the patient didn't have before. What we're doing is taking an immunity they've got in a shaky sense and making it work much more efficiently.
So there's no risk of autoimmune being triggered using your approach?
No. This has got nothing to do with autoimmune disease.
Great. Okay, so it sounds like a very safe approach. Would that be fair to say?
Look, I'm only I'm missing every second word.
Okay. So I'm interested in what you were saying about the payer patches, because that's also involved in IgA nephropathy and other diseases, isn't it? Can you talk a little bit about that?
The payer, if you think, most people who think of immunology think of the systemic immune system. That is the system that operates in the blood, and where you have lymph nodes and spleens, which generate body and the T-cells. For the mucosa, for the lining system, it's a very different system. They have lymph nodes, they have Peyer's patches, little aggregates, like a lymph node, but they're in the mucosal surface, particularly of the gut. So when you swallow, say, bacteria and viruses that you're inhaling in into the lungs, you have this constant stream of mucus that about a cup that you don't know. And in that is all the bacteria and viruses. And so what you've actually got is a system whereby you're developing the immunity through lymph nodes, but through past patches. And they're little aggregates, little tiny collections of T and B cells stimulated. A bit like a lymph node waits for a measles vaccine or a tetanus vaccine, which is injected into you. So this way you're actually getting it by people swallowing it, getting into the gut.
Mm. And this is sort of related to what's happening now in terms of looking at fecal transplants and that sort of system for
No. It's nothing to do with that.
Okay.
No.
Okay. I'm just thinking of the whole system.
Looking at trying to change the microbiome.
Yes.
That's pathogenic.
So you're not involved in that. So the microbiome isn't part of.
Well, I work with the guy who started. You know, he was my PhD student, the chap who started all of this,
Tom,
and who's working on refining it.
Thomas Barodi, are you talking about?
Tom Barodi, yes.
Yes. Okay.
So, I know.
Was he?
It's incredibly effective in some cases, and it's a work in progress in others.
Hmm. How have you responded to COVID? Because obviously you've been working on this vaccine the method that you're approaching, you've been working on for decades.
We call it an immunobiotic, not a vaccine.
Immunobiotic, beautiful. Thank
immunobiotic,
you. So I'm going to complain on Google because they've given you the title of developing a vaccine, which doesn't sound like the truth.
Google gets a lot of things wrong.
I've noticed that.
Particularly when you have big pharma companies rewriting the Wikipedia.
Have they done that for you?
My grandkids tell me they have. I don't bother reading it.
How did you respond when they were creating a inverted commas vaccine in such rapid time? What were your thoughts about this?
Well, I think what I said was what I wrote in January of 21? Yeah,
yep.
21.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote an article there and said it just doesn't make sense. They clearly don't understand the biology of infection of the airways. And I'm incredibly concerned about anyone who's injecting essentially genetic material, which is going to be spread throughout the body and where you've got a completely uncontrolled amount of antigen produced. I mean, basically, we're now talking about vaccines, not what we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
Vaccines have a very precise small amount of antigen. If you put in genetic material, it goes to every cell potentially in the body, and every cell can make this antigen, and you get an extraordinary range of potential disadvantages, which is exactly what we've found. So it was all everything that's happened with the messenger RNA vaccines could and should have been predicted 2.5 years ago. There's nothing secret. Biology was there for anyone to see who understood it.
And the problem was, of course, this wasn't made public knowledge, was it? Was anyone interviewing you? And
I think the sadness is, who in my own profession should have known better, and it's not their area. I mean, there was nobody that I know of in this country, and possibly anywhere else, who understood mucosal immunology.
Wow.
It's just a fact. If they did, they weren't doing a very good job.
What would you have done if it was, if you were...
What would I have done?
If you were the chief medical officer.
I would never, ever have developed that genetic vaccine. Oh, well, no, I mean, no one's asked me before, but I'll tell you what I would have done. Would never, ever have developed a genetic vaccine because there's not a jot of evidence that they're better than a traditional vaccine. Can no you... evidence at all. It was never needed. What I would have done is a bit like what Nick Petrovsky's done in Adelaide. He's produced a fantastic vaccine that really works as well as, or at least as well, as any of these genetic ones without the side effects and disadvantages. And yet no one wants to know about him. No one wants to know about his vaccine, except there's already 9 to 10 million doses being sold and used in other countries.
And what's the research on that showing? And why weren't they interested?
To continue answering your question.
Yeah.
So the things I would have done is I would not have used a genetic vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I would have developed a traditional antigen vaccine. Three, I would have honestly said this is going to work like a flu vaccine, because that's exactly how they do work.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings in enormous limitations because the whole 80-year history of vaccinating against respiratory virus infections is that by injecting a vaccine, you don't get particularly good responses, and they're very short-lasting. And you certainly, you know, any vaccine where you need five vaccinations in 2 years and you end up getting a 20% reduction of protection can't be a particularly good vaccine, could it? I mean, this week there was a paper that I saw by... the Cleveland Clinic group. Now, this is, you know, not a group of amateurs. These are very good people. What they did was a very important study in 40,000 people, all the people who worked for the Cleveland Clinic, which, you know, is one of the best clinics in the world. And they were surprised. They found that the people who, and the question they asked was, what's the benefit of having being up to, I use the word up to date with your vaccines. In other words, you've had all your boosters. And when they compared the ones who were not up to date with the ones who were up to date, the ones who were not up to date had 20% less infections of COVID than the ones who were up to date. In other words, the information we're being given to have repeated vaccinations turns off the immune response. It's just like if you go to an allergist and say, I'm allergic to grass pollen, the allergist will give you a series of injections, exactly the same as you're getting with the COVID vaccine. And the aim is to turn off the immune response to the allergens that you're inhaling because they're coming through the mucosal route in the airways. And it's exactly the same as having repeated vaccines for COVID. I know it sounds terrible and it doesn't sound logical, but it is totally logical if you understand how the mucosal immune response handles infections via the airway.
So given that you were aware of this and other people were aware of this from the beginning, what happened?
Well, I certainly was, and I wrote about it. I'm sure that there must – I can't speak for other people. I can only speak for myself.
How do you you're in charge?
I make this point. Every time I made the point, I got jumped upon from a large height.
What else would you have done in terms of nutritional medicine? There's a lot of research that's been done into the effectiveness of vitamin D and to correct vitamin D deficiency.
What else would I have done?
Yeah,
I would have done a lot of the sensible things. I think there's good evidence that if you've got a low vitamin D, you get poorer response to COVID. I think that hydroxychloroquine had fantastic results and got completely taken out by the big pharma companies driving a no campaign. It's not very good to have a no campaign, it seems, these days. The story now is that, of course, hydroxychloroquine would have saved probably thousands of lives in Australia. If it had been properly used. You go back and you remember what it was like in those days, 2 or 3 years ago. You were told to stay at home until you couldn't breathe and then go to hospital. It was just extraordinary. when there were, you know, at that time there was chloroquine available, and later ivermectin became available, both, you know, very effective drugs and well-proven drugs when used properly.
Has this ever happened before where people have been told to just stay at home until they can't breathe?
Look, I can't hear you. Can you say that again, please?
Has this ever happened before? Like, do you know of any other viruses where people have been told not to even try a treatment?
No, not at all. This is complete. In my 50 years as working as a specialist immunologist, physician, it's unique. It's extraordinary, quite unique.
Well, Clive Palmer landed 50 million odd doses of hydroxychloroquine into the country early on, and was willing to donate it to the Australian public, and it was seized by the Australian government, held for ages till it went away. Yeah, they wouldn't even let it out for regular use.
All part of a program to protect the so-called to protect the vaccine, which didn't even exist at that stage. It was an extraordinary. Driven by big influences on the WHO. WHO came out pretty early in 2020 and before their own trial was even finished and basically said, you know, this is a terribly toxic drug, you can't use it. And the same occurred in the States. The guy who started looking at it in America made the big mistake of writing an open letter to the current president, who was Trump. And that didn't go down terribly well with the press. The big pharma companies are very, very powerful, and they knew they had very expensive antivirals on the way. They didn't want highly effective, non-toxic, safe, cheap medications like hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin being used. It was as simple as that.
In your 50 years of experience, has this happened before? Were you surprised?
I was amazed. Mm. I wrote an article back then in early 21. I think it was in Quadrant from memory, and I basically said, look, you know, this is really, really interesting. You know, if you use it early and you understand the drug, then it really looks very effective. The next day, my university, who forgot that they'd just given me their first and only doctor of science for working in this area for 30 years, put out a thing saying, we don't recognise Professor Clancy as an expert in this area.
Wow.
And it went to every press outlet, and I got laughed at on the ABC. Not that it worries me if I get laughed at by the ABC, because I laugh at them, but it was extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary.
And I'm looking here at c19early.com, and there's 395 studies on hydroxychloroquine being used for COVID with over 500,000 patients in 58 countries. So there's a giant body of research
there. The whole point is that, if you get herpes zoster, you get shingles, mm-hmm. How long have you got to effectively treat it with an antiviral, with acyclovir? How long have you got? 24 hours, maybe 48?
Mm-hmm.
They get very sick and you go to hospital and you treat them. What happens? They don't get better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you're treating viral infections, you treat them in the, you really should be treating them in the first 24 hours. In other words, every nursing home should have had bottles of these things so they could treat in fact, prophylactically treat the people in those nursing homes.
So with your doctor colleagues who over the time were gradually advising and injecting more people, and you were standing back and saying, this is not the right thing to do, how did they treat you? I mean, did they listen? Did they?
Well, I've got a very good relationship with all my colleagues, but it was never discussed with me. Never. I offered to debate this with anybody who wanted to debate it, you know, just to have a friendly, you know, interactive debate, which is how we run medicine. no takers. The people who were knocking it probably have never written a prescription for hydroxychloroquine.
Hmm.
So what do you think made them such zealots?
Well, it was part of the narrative. The narrative was developed through the WHO, through the big power influences of money, politics. People bought it. They bought it. Extraordinary. It's unique.
What do you think? I mean, obviously now people are seeing the consequences. I'm sure most people.
I think the thing to realize is that we now know. I mean, anybody who is smart enough to put hcqmeta.com into their computer and has a look at the 200 or 300 papers of and those who have been early treated, and look at the meta-analyses. They've got to be pretty stupid if they say it doesn't work. Mm. Now, you know, the people who say it doesn't work don't do that, or don't want to do that, or are paid not to.
Do you think the vaccines are causing harm to people? I mean, there's been some correlation between the excess deaths
We know they are.
When you say we know, who's we? Because...
Well, anyone who wants to look at the data.
Okay.
You've got, well, I just quoted you the latest Cleveland Clinic study of 40,000 people. I think what you're seeing now, you're starting to see things emerging in the mainline press. Not so much the press, but certainly in some of the better journals, which would never have been published. Mm-hmm. They're all suppressed in the past. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden we're finding, I mean, when you have the Australian Senate, and I'm not a politician, and I don't get involved in politics, but I have to say, I could not believe that the Australian Senate voted against investigating why there's a 15% increase in mortality across the Australian states correlating with the vaccine rollouts. Mm. 15% increase. Now, you know about it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you wouldn't be running this program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And anybody who, who wants to ask the question can quickly find that out.
Well, I was reading the Spectator.
I saw an analysis this week where you're in Melbourne, of the admissions of kids between 18 and 30 into Melbourne hospitals with heart, either with acute cardiac arrest or acute coronary artery disease. And there was a huge peak that occurred corresponding with the vaccine rollouts.
Just like in Israel,
There's all evidence like this. Look, what I say is these are all red flags. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a world expert on anything. Yeah, I know a little bit about this and that. What I'm saying is that there is so much evidence around that says, well, hey, wait a second, there could be a very serious issue here. This is a red flag, and, we should be looking at this and sorting it out. But, of course, no one wants to do that. What they want to do is get billions of dollars for setting up, and this is the thing that really worries me, setting up companies in Australia to make genetic vaccines for every vaccine. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the vets are getting on to it for meat-producing
livestock,
animals.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how stupid is that? How stupid is that? When we've still only got an experimental vaccine, which is increasingly linked with high mortality, high adverse events, high serious adverse events. I mean, one of the sub-editors of the British Medical Journal did an amazing study, really good guy with some of the best statisticians in the world, and found that using the Pfizer data, the forced released Pfizer data, showed that you've got a better chance of going to hospital from getting the vaccine than you would have got from getting there's a higher chance of going to hospital from the vaccine than not going because of any hospitalization that was prevented as a result of having the vaccine. Now, that's all published data.
And is it published? So... We have.
That's the British Medical Journal. This is,
Was that in the papers here or not?
No, of course not.
And what do you attribute the lack of honesty in our mainstream press? Because obviously things have been censored quite extensively. And
well, you're aware of the Trusted News Initiative, which began in 1918, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. 20.
2018 they started, before COVID.
2018. 2018 for the around the political stuff.
Not 1918, sorry, 2018. Yeah,
that was a good year.
Sorry, 2018. In 2018, they got together with a section of Google And Google has given $400 million donation to the WHO.
Wow.
So you can see the linkage. You get a lot of money, isn't it? You didn't know that, did you?
No.
And very interesting. And I wrote an article in Spectator last week, I think it was, and I think all of that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, they decided they would, very meritorious, they said, we're going to prevent misinformation mm-hmm. being, spread through the news outlets. Along came COVID, and of course, the WHO linked up with them, with their very special thoughts and views. And so the press became a complete outlet. You had young kids who are usually cover legal cases and court cases writing as experts, instead of reporting the news, they all became experts in interpreting the news. And some appalling articles were presented that mm-hmm. were so wrong and so dangerously wrong. You're aware of them, I'm aware mm-hmm. of them, and probably mm-hmm. most of the people listening to this are aware of them.
Maybe not, because we're just free-to-air mm-hmm. radio. So some people are listening to this and may never have heard anything about this before.
Well, I'll tell you one example. The Sydney Morning Herald, which is probably pretty similar, you had it in The Age, they mm-hmm. had this girl who apparently is a very good crime reporter, and she wrote an article about, I think it was ivermectin,
mm-hmm.
and it was so appallingly wrong that I contacted her
mm-hmm.
And said, look, why don't you to get it right? And she wrote me back a note and said, oh, we only publish randomized controlled trials. So I then sent her the results of, I think it was 39 randomized controlled trials for ivermectin. Never heard another word. And that's the quality of the press that we have in this country.
They just repeat what they're allowed to know. I mean, I had an incident. The reason I got so interested in it was that I was speaking to Tom Barodi early on about the triple therapy approach that he'd, and they'd already discovered here in Melbourne around the effectiveness of ivermectin. And I spoke to an AGE journalist who wanted to do an article on it, and then she contacted me a few days later and said, I'm not allowed to. And that's what made me alerted to it, because, we were dealing with, hundreds of people dying in the nursing homes, and we knew that there was the nursing home in Toronto where nobody had died.
Here's something you can validate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I sat down a couple of weeks ago, and I looked at the total mortality over time from the beginning of COVID basically to, a month or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the pattern in Australia, we had very few people die. I'm looking at mortality here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very few people died in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little peak, I think, in August of 21. And then late 21, it started taking off. And when the rest of the world, because they'd built up, I guess, a degree of natural immunity, which we didn't have,
mm-hmm.
when they were getting very little, we started getting huge numbers of people dying. And in fact, my calculations roughly were that the number of people dying per million population in Australia is very, very similar to the number dying per million in the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So all the things we went through basically mm-hmm. had no net effect.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had properly handled the situation initially, so that we provided every nursing home with hydroxychloroquine and then ivermectin,
mm-hmm.
We would have saved the lives of many, many mm-hmm. of those mm-hmm. people. In my view.
So you wouldn't have shut things down. You would have taken the Swedish approach, like in terms of, because you're
I think the Swedish approach became more clearly enumerated in what was called the Great Barrington Declaration
mm-hmm.
by three of the world's leading epidemiologists two from the States and one from, I think it was Oxford
mm-hmm.
University in England, and basically they said, look, young people aren't getting. They're not going to die. Very, very few are going to get very sick. Don't close down society, but protect the vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone wants to protect the vulnerable. And there were ways of protecting the vulnerable. What is so absolutely crazy is that the decision-making was taken away from the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
The decision-making was made by bureaucrats, politicians, and vested interests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And their decision, I mean, for example, just take the hydroxychloroquine one. What harm would it have done
mm-hmm.
for every nursing home person to have mm-hmm. two or three tablets of hydroxychloroquine every week in prevention, and something like a dozen tablets for, yeah, three tablets a day for 5 days, mm-hmm. If they got COVID. What harm would that have done? And the answer is basically none. Basically none. So in other words, you had nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm. And there was research. This is how doctors work.
Well, the data was there for anyone to look at.
Wasn't there the data from Israel? Was that Eli Schwartz, was it, from Israel, who had shown that even by taking early treatment...
Well,
there's
some very interesting data now that's been coming out of Israel, because they became the laboratory for Pfizer.
Mm-hmm.
The immunization programs in Israel were basically managed and supported by Pfizer. And, you know, there was all sorts of fantastic news, et cetera. And then all of a sudden they found that more people were getting infected, that it had more vaccines, and that was confirmed with the Cleveland Clinic study. It was confirmed in New South Wales when, I think in December, pretty much everyone in intensive care units had been triple or quadruple vaccinated. I mean, you know, the data's all over the place. But, of course, it's And it's biologically exactly what you'd predict.
Yes, that must be very frustrating for you.
That's the bottom line. There's nothing surprising about what we're seeing.
It must be very difficult for you, having seen it, predicted it, and now having to reflect on how foolish it was to ignore the voices of people with the wisdom and knowledge that you had. I'm just going to ask you a question generally about the vaccine approach. I just had my hairdresser ask me, her son is going to childcare and she's been told she has to have all the vaccines within a 6-month period.
I changed my childcare.
What's your thoughts on the childhood vaccine schedule? I've just been listening to...
It's the same as anyone who looks at the data.
Okay, tell me about that.
It's terrible, terrible.
Why?
You know, because it does no good and a hell of a lot of potential damage. It doesn't prevent them spreading the disease. Everyone knows that. It does have nasty side effects in a number, and it doesn't protect. You know, they don't get.
At one stage,
I checked hospital in the middle of this argument in Sydney, and not one child. Has there been one child admitted because they were really sick from COVID?
Okay.
And there was a long silence. And the only ones that had been admitted were for social reasons, you know, that their parents couldn't look after them or something like that.
So, Robert, just with regards to normal vaccines, because there's now so many vaccines in the childhood schedule, do you think that they're pushing, like, you know, when we grew up, we only had maybe, you know, 6 vaccines. Now they're, I think, up to 70 in America. I think it's 70.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting, isn't it?
You know, why are babies getting Hep B on the day they're born? Like, is that valuable? Well, that's a more normal vaccine.
I'm an immunologist, and I've been promoting vaccines all my working life.
Yeah,
my comments are the use of genetic messenger RNA vaccines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not commenting on any other aspect, because vaccination have changed our world or can help contribute to changing our world to a much safer world. And, you know, for people to not have the standard pediatric vaccines, in my view, is foolish, because the data has been around for a long while. I think my comments are basically just restricted to
mRNA.
The issue that COVID highlighted, when a company wants to make a lot of money, which makes $100 billion a year out of COVID,
mm-hmm.
With its Paxlovid,
mm-hmm.
And its messenger RNA vaccine. And I think that's terribly wrong, wrong. When they must know the problems, I would imagine. They can't not.
I was reading today in the Spectator, and the article was talking about Shane Warne. And Warney had a heart attack and passed away. And they were saying that there is a lot of evidence around the world linking heart attacks in relatively young adult men. And it's connected, like, 6 months later. And just wondering how you can connect an injection from 6 months ago to a heart attack that happens to one of our national icons.
Well, very easily, because if you look at, if you understand the mechanism of damage, damage is chronic inflammation. And the reason is difficult. Say you inject a messenger RNA vaccine and it goes into all the cells, which we know it does, in the brain and the heart. Say the heart, for example. Now, it goes into the cells which are in the coronary arteries. They're expressing on their surface a foreign protein. And make a foreign protein, so you make an immune response, so you're protected against that foreign protein when it attacks you in the form of a virus infection, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, the body's smart, but it's not smart enough to say, well, wait a second, this is on my coronary arteries. It sees the spike protein, and it makes a T-cell immune response. And this has been demonstrated. This was demonstrated by pathologists in Germany, and I understand one of the senior guys involved had his life threatened for actually publishing this data. That's all by hearsay, so it may not be correct, but what I heard. It's interesting, I haven't heard much from him since he did this. But he showed pictures of the T cells infiltrating the heart, infiltrating the brain, and this is chronic inflammation. And so you may well get an immediate myocarditis and you get immediate symptoms and the heart may stop and you may be a sportsman with a lot of adrenaline, which we know makes these things worse, and you die on a sport field. This is unprecedented numbers of sportsmen have been dying on sports fields. But it may also be that you're actually accelerating an inflammatory process like coronary artery disease or in the brain, and that can occur over weeks or months. And we certainly know that the spike protein is persistent for months. People are showing it in the blood in these exosomes, which they can find in blood. So the spike protein doesn't just come and go. So you've got a chronic inflammatory process. And of course it's going to affect over short-term and long-term.
So to summarise, are you saying that we were mandated to get an injection that down the line is going to be causing random deaths in, I don't know, hundreds, thousands, millions?
I'm not using that sentence. What I'm saying is, and I don't get involved in the politics or public health issues, I'm simply saying that the messenger RNA vaccines, in my view, should never have been used. They should be stopped because the red flags are flying and people must investigate these red flags, ranging from the deaths on playing fields through to the 15% increase in mortality we're seeing across the vaccinated world. That's all I'm saying. That we
there's a lot of warnings around.
In fact,
there's a lot of warnings around. I'm saying there are people who have taken this injection and they may have some minor inflammation and it comes along and all of a sudden...
Absolutely. Look, in my own family, both my daughter and her husband were admitted to hospital, one with a cerebral event and one with a pulmonary embolus. That's just in my family.
Wow.
Now, that's not the reason I have these views.
Hmm.
These are not isolated, rare events.
Yeah. And
neither of them were reported. The hospital would not report either as a vaccine side effect.
On Sunday, we have a thing called Forest of the Fallen happening, if anyone's listening, at Caulfield Park, 10:30 a.m. Sunday morning, I think at the corner of Hawthorne Roads and Balaclava Road. And it's an exhibition of, I think, 500 people whose families have either been harmed or died, and because they've been unable to express their experiences through media, they just do this exhibition around the country. So that's a way, if anyone's interested in hearing people's experiences, unfortunately it's something that needs to be addressed. And you know, hearing from someone like Professor Robert Clancy, who's on the show with us today, you're listening to JAIR FM and this is The Third Opinion Uncensored. And we're the only Jewish community radio show in Australia. But what what we'd like to, you know, to do is trying to make that link. There are also interesting treatments happening through Canada. There are some treatments which are happening with within a community, so it's peer-to-peer support. And so there are doctors around the world who are working on people who have had severe adverse events. So, there is stuff happening, not that much in Australia, unfortunately.
Anyway, we should say thank you. And
I've got to go because I've got something I have to do. But I wish you well.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us, and we really appreciate the work you've done. And we know speaking out is hard to do, and there are consequences. But as time goes on, the narrative is flipping, and people are starting to see the underbelly of all of this.
Well, thanks. Of luck.
Thank you,
thank
Professor.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
JO needs your membership. Membership keeps us on air for only $54 a year. Your membership enables us to pay our bills, provide quality radio, like the show you're currently listening to. Join up via our website,
And if you don't like it, you don't need to listen.
There was a lot to unpack in that. But
you can't complain unless you pay for a membership.
I think that's probably the only radio station in the world that I heard. We heard what we just heard.
Mate, he knows what he's talking about, and this is big. And I can't believe it doesn't make the papers, doesn't make the radio. Even when you talk to someone in the street, are there 15% more deaths? Is that important?
Listen, censorship is scary. It's super scary. And as a person who has worked in media and studied media, I have found this from the beginning to be the most frightening part of it all. And we would see the wars on Facebook. I was sometimes a subject of attack because I was saying things which was science, and people just could not believe that they would not know that. If that was true, why don't I know that? If that's not if that was true, why wouldn't my doctor tell me? And there was no awareness that doctors were forbidden to say negative things about the vaccine, and they weren't allowed to engage. Is that right? What's the limitations? Because there was something that came through from APRA.
You weren't allowed to do anything that would interfere with the vaccine rollout.
So that involved...
You didn't want to cause vaccine hesitancy.
So talking about early treatment, because they banned ivermectin for a couple of years. Now it's back on.
First time in history.
Okay. So on, I think it was September the 10th, 2021... ivermectin was banned. It was being used for treatment, and it was effective. It wasn't because it was unsafe. They said it was because it would cause
vaccine hesitancy.
But on June the 1st, ivermectin's back on your doctor's playlist. So,
well, just as a personal message from me, because I've been feeling this for a long time, never said it, but the arrogance and the ignorance of those who spread the COVID vaccine, go get it and save my granny. Listen to what's going on now. And look, that's all past. But the time now, everyone needs to realise what's going on and
it wasn't
do
just
something
a
about it.
It wasn't a mistake. Was it? Was it an error of judgment?
Warnie
or was
reckons
it, something
it was a mistake.
Oh, dear. Poor old Warnie.
What?
No, nothing. I don't know how you reverse 5 doses of vaccine. How do you reverse it?
Well, there's only, you know, a few million people around the country who are wondering the same thing.
I just want to also say something, though, because I think that this generates fear, and I don't think that's the right thing. The reality is there were bad batches, and the people that were most harmed were from batches, and they know. They know if you've been harmed from a vaccine generally, you would know within 6 months.
So go to your doctor who gave you the vaccine and ask him what you should do about preventing the possible side effects.
Anyway, we're going to cut it short by a few minutes tonight. This has been a very enlightening discussion, I think.
Maybe next week. I'm going to try and see if
maybe
we can
get somebody off from the health department to defend the last 3 weeks of what we've heard.
Well, yes, that'd be fantastic if somebody from the health department wanted to come in and discuss these. I mean, this is worldwide evidence. We're not talking about models. We're talking about historical data.
I think
this is no argument.
I think it's worth having a listen to the interview between Joe Rogan and Robert F. Kennedy that was just played last week.
3 hours of my life was worthwhile.
You can cut it down to a 55-minute show. Even,
okay,
then
all right,
next week.
Let's play some of it. It's Look, I think the reality is, and as Robert Kennedy said, it's been 19 years since he's been allowed to actually tell his story because he's a very evidence-based, you know, environmental lawyer who got involved in things because he's got a strong push for the truth, and he's devastated by seeing what's happening and what's happened in government. So very interesting.
Well, it's also not a real
me up.
It's not a real stretch to think that the company that's had more criminal fines than anyone in the history of the world might have told a few porkies about the evidence.
Please don't name anybody. Thank you, and we'll see you next. What's today, Thursday? Thursday, maybe. Unless the station somehow just burns and falls.
They were personal views.
They were personal views, exactly. Thank you. Not the views of the station. Mike Store, see you later, everybody.
J-Air, 88 FM.
Hi, this is Mark Kopolov with a reminder that you can support J-Air by joining as a member at j-air.com. jair.com.au. Your membership fee of $54 a year will help JAIR maintain its commitment of bringing your community to you.
Hello, this is Graham Kemlow with a quick reminder to tune in to the Travel Writers Show every Wednesday from 5 p.m. We'll not only inform you, but inspire you with stories of food, wine, lifestyle and travel.